Blair Shepherd thinks big. And from his vantage point, he says there are only 10 years to midnight, which is the title of his book that addresses four urgent global crises and the strategies needed to solve them. It is not a book he wanted to write. He didn't seek out these crises. Rather, they emerged as he traveled the globe, observing trends in India, Spain, UK, the United States, along with a dozen other countries. Shepherd is the former dean of the business school at Duke University and the global head of strategy and leadership at PricewaterhouseCoopers. He's an optimist by nature, and he's worried about our collective future. The reason he's concerned is the scope of the challenges the world faces and the big thinking that is needed to address them by people with the power to make the necessary changes. We invited Blair Shepherd to join us for a conversation that matters about the major issues facing us all and the insights, strategies, and courage needed to address them.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Blair Shepherd, welcome to Conversations That Matter. You have a very interesting book that you published, 10 Years to Midnight. It is not an optimistic view of the future. What I find interesting is I see you as an optimist. You must have had a hard time accepting these concepts and issues that are the focus of your book.
Yeah, so first of all, I'm really honored to be on, actually. And so it's really wonderful to be talking to a fellow Canadian. We came to the answer really quite unhappily, right? I mean, it started harmlessly. We were just trying to say, is our strategy resilient, right? And then what came up is the same pattern came up again and again, which is we have a problem now. It gets worse next year. And if we don't deal with it in 10 years, it's a really serious issue. And it's systemic, and therefore it's hard to change, right? And that pattern just replicated. And so, you know, I hadn't written in 20 years, and I intended to be invisible. My goal at PwC is to support other people, right, in being successful. And we just had to tell the story because it's a story we can solve, but we got to get to it really fast.
Yeah. You say this isn't something that we need to be addressing in 10 years. You say we need to be addressing these issues now and solving them within 10 years. These are big, complex challenges you bring up. I like your acronym ADAPT as a platform that speaks to the pressing need to adapt strategies and policies and how that forms the platform of your thesis. So let's start with the letter A, which represents asymmetry, and in particular, the asymmetrical distribution of wealth. Why is this such an important starting point?
Well, it's actually three kinds of asymmetry simultaneously, right? Three kinds of disparity. So the first one is actually the growing disparity between wealth and income generators and between income generators themselves, right? So that's between individuals. And it's concentrating in a way that just is really unhealthy. But I think that's actually the least important of the three. The next one is actually the intergenerational gap, right? So you have kids graduating with massive debt into a job market that's terrible, with the tax burden we've created for them, never really being able to afford a house, because think about where you live, the cost of a house and median income, they'll never get it, right? And right. And then the final one is interregional. So think about in Canada, for example, urban versus rural. There's a huge gap and it's growing. Those last two are really hard to undo. So it's big, and it's everywhere in the world, by the way, everywhere in the world.
Well, I take a look at the situation in rural communities. If you have developed a market for yourself, you can do well in rural environments because of the interconnectedness of everything. You are no longer isolated. In fact, you have lower land and rent costs and therefore a greater return on your revenues than you may have if you're in urban environments.
Well, I mean, you've actually gotten the optimistic part of the story, right? If we basically step back and said, let's think about driving thriving local economies first, there is an answer. Mm-hmm. But we sort of, I can't tell you the number of times in a conversation where people say, I'm going to solve the problems. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the major innovation centers in the world and I'm going to locate there, right? So I'm going to locate in Toronto or Waterloo. I'm going to locate in San Francisco. I'm going to locate in London. I'm going to locate in Sydney. And then they forget the rest of the world. And so there's this kind of mental model of globalization that says we all need to be Barcelona, right? And we shouldn't all be Barcelona. But if we turned it on its head, like you said, and said, what about, couldn't we create thriving rural communities? Of course we could. But one quick example, you know, in if you go 150 miles north of Helsinki, almost every village there, the median age is 59 to 60. Mm-hmm. There's no attorney, no doctor, no theater, one grocery store and one bank branch. And you say, well, just leave and go to Helsinki. Well, it turns out the housing values have been so destroyed that they can't realize enough money to live there. So they're stuck in a terrible place. Easy, and they're beautiful places, by the way. You know, it's like the places in the mountains in Vancouver, in British Columbia and in Muskoka. They're beautiful, but they're just dying.
I also think about this asymmetrical relationship with technology. There are those who are prospering from it, and there are those who are completely outside of that economic environment that has created extraordinary wealth.
Yeah. Yeah, so the interesting issue there is Apple traded at the FTSE 100 plus $500 billion 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
That's incredible concentration of wealth, right? All of the British stock exchange was $500 billion in one company. Right? And it tends to be located in a place, and the wealth tends to concentrate in that place, right? So platforms have created ridiculous wealth concentration, right? They don't have to, by the way. You actually articulated an example why they don't have to. We could use platforms to distribute activity, but we've used them to concentrate, right? And it's as bad as the moguls in India, right, we're seeing right now. And that's not sustainable.
Jordy Rose, the brain behind the quantum computing company D-Wave in Vancouver, he's left that and now moved on to address the development of humanoid artificial intelligence. And while doing so, he openly worries about the impact of AI on human beings who will be displaced as a result. He says to address the myriad issues that such a workforce displacement will create is to develop an ambitious AI tax that provides governments with the resources needed to support an out-of-work population.
Yeah, it will actually. I mean, so there are these three challenges with technology going forward, this particular technology, which is economic. You described it, concentration of wealth and job loss, right? And it's really challenging because the people are going to lose a job around the world actually have pretty serious personal debt. And so they're going to try to find a job while indebted, which is really hard, right? Second challenge is social, right? So that, you know, kids are committing suicide at a higher rate. There's lots of reasons, not just mm-hmm. social media, but it's one. And then the third one is the one you went to, which is as AI comes on board, it accelerates that. And it actually, it's invisible to see what it's doing, right? So it's a double problem.
In your ADAPT acronym framework, the D stands for disruption. And this is what we're talking about. We see various forces at work that are disrupting the way we have functioned over the past 70 to 80 years post-Second World War. Now many of those systems, organizations, and institutions are no longer meeting larger societal challenges. If we continue in this direction, the disruption can lead to a revolution, which I think is a horrible response to disruption.
Yeah, we're losing faith in institutions, right? And the primary reason is the institutions aren't keeping up with the pace of change that's happening in the world, and therefore they're not supporting us the way they need to. And when we lose faith in institutions, really bad things happen. I think you're right. Revolution is one of them, right? And I think so we have to get to an answer of those three problems really, really quickly.
And the cost of revolution is incredibly high, is it not?
It's really high. I mean, we are at a point. So if you think about the trust in institutions that exist today, we're at a point where the Harvard School was saying we're on the edge of revolution, right? And if you study history, good things don't happen when that occurs. Society goes into a really bad place for a long period of time. And I'd rather we didn't do that this round.
Do you think, as far as mindset is concerned, there is still a Malthusian philosophy of limited supply? And so, therefore, I get to win if you lose. It's the only way I can get what I want. Or do you believe that we're moving to a more egalitarian view rooted in the idea that with expanded opportunity, there is then abundance and we can all prosper? Or are we caught somewhere between those two theories?
Yeah, I think we are. And I think there's sort of three places where that plays, right? So one of them is international relations. The world's fracturing, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you could look at it is say, isn't it wonderful we're running all these experiments to find out what the next version of a good political economy should be? That's the way I actually look at it personally. You know, I used to compete as an athlete, and I hated the person I was competing with when, in the moment I was competing, but I loved them after because they made me better, right? They just make me better. So China will make the U.S. better. The U.S. will make China better. So compete healthily, right? That's one. The second one is this issue about technology. It's kind of winner take all. And if we could reframe it as let's make this inclusive, we'd be way better off. And the third one is I do think this one will force us to realize we're interdependent, which is the climate actually is a limited resource and we're destroying it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's one where I think by understanding that it is kind of a zero-sum game with nature, we might bring ourselves together and be more cooperative in the other things we have to do.
Right.
We can all get wealthy. We don't have to restrict wealth.
I believe that to be true. You know, Aristotle pointed out a couple of thousand years ago, the failure of one individual to realize their full potential is a loss to all of society.
I'll tell you a bizarre example of that, by the way, which is I was friends of the son of a person who was a mafia down in a town not too far from where I lived. And I didn't know this until college. And I went back and said to him, I have a question for you. I said, so are you who I think you are? And he said, you don't want me to answer that question. Well, I said, can I ask another question? He said, sure. He said, you're the best citizen this town has. How can you be who you are and be a great citizen? And his answer was pretty interesting. He said, you don't want to be who I am in a city that's not thriving.
Ah.
So even he understood the thing you said, right? Which is we're all better off when everyone's better off, right? And right. So let's think about a system where GDP, it's not just growth in GDP, it's a dispersion of success across the country as well as general growth. It's both things.
Next up, the second A, age. And this is a big, big issue, especially when we look at the makeup of population around the world. The disparity between northern hemispheric countries versus southern hemispheric countries. We look at what is happening in Asia. China has a one-child policy, or it did, and that became the cultural norm. And despite the fact that the law has been changed, young couples are choosing to have only one child because that is what they know. So 40 years from now, China will be hit with a significant population reduction. We in North America watched the birth rate fall starting in the late 50s, and other northern hemispheric countries are also facing the same challenges associated with an aging population and a declining birth rate. The result will be tremendous social and economic consequences. So given all of that, how do we collectively come together to address this issue? Because it's a really big global challenge. It extends far beyond any one border.
If you take Canada, for example, I think there are five taxpayers for every person drawing on the system now, right? And that's going to be 2-to-1 soon. And the system can't afford itself when that happens, right? So clearly, Canada is going to have to use immigration as an answer and stimulate the economy. But the problem is, if they steal the best from Nigeria, then we've harmed Nigeria.
Right.
So I think the important point is we have to simultaneously think about the young countries and how we help them grow and support themselves, and the older country and how we take advantage of some of the talent from those countries. So instead of just stealing the best and the brightest, what if we actually brought them to universities in the West, in the United States, UK, Canada, for example, educated them, and then had them go back and establish and strengthen their own, right? Keep some, but send the rest back. What if we actually held some of the IP in Canada, but actually did the manufacturing or the service production in Africa? And so you can find symbiosis if you thought above the level of the nation state. But if we stay at the nation state level, we'll never solve this collective problem.
So what is your concern about how this is going to play out? If we have these aging, declining populations in the north, ballooning young populations in the south, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where there are emerging economies that are not growing quite fast enough to meet the needs of a baby boom that dwarfs the one in the Americas after the Second World War. So these countries don't have the infrastructure to support their needs. And without being paternalistic in our efforts to work with these countries, what do we do to work in harmony with a world that is upside down when it comes to age and population distribution?
Yeah, let's actually put some numbers behind that and then answer the question, right? So there are 22 countries with a median age under 20 in Africa.
Right.
The total population of those countries is 885 million. So there's a half, an average of those about 18 and a half, right? So a half a billion kids need an education, a job in the next decade. That's why it's 10 years, right? It turns out under the present system, I don't see that happening. So we kind of have to, and what really worries me is that Africa in some parts is thinking about replicating the Chinese model for how to grow. And the problem is that actually the West isn't buying anymore, right? And they're competing with AI and robots. So that can't be the answer. So we have to help Africa create its own solution for how it creates thriving local economies that work with each other and then compete globally, but first thriving local economies. And do that in a decade, right? And I think what we have to bring money, intellectual power, but support them in their own success, not impose ideas.
I think that is fundamental. Now, under the letter P in ADAPT, that stands for polarization, which is growing, especially in Northern Hemisphere countries. So knowing we need to work with emerging nations, and at the same time we have a waning interest in doing that, I see we are facing a challenge in the collective development of ideas that will meet the needs of everyone. And I mean that globally, because this is an issue that every country has to come to grips with. And so we need to be very careful not to show up with the solution. Rather, we have to develop it together.
More harm was done in the name of the liberal ideal than you can ever imagine, because we imposed our views on places where they don't work.
Mm-hmm.
We have to let them solve their own problems, but help, because they clearly need money. They clearly need intellectual resources. They clearly need other resources, but let it come from them, not be imposed from above.
That's the only way that it is sustainable from my perspective.
Yep. Yeah. And if you think about Canada's success, part of the reason Canada succeeded is it created its own independent economic activity from Britain, right? Mm-hmm. The U.S. was the interlocked more than Canada was in a funny way. And so Canada actually was able to succeed and become a dominion where the U.S. had to have a revolution, right? We don't want a revolution from Central Africa. We want them to become their own successful dominions.
So to do all of this, you talk about trust, which represents the T in ADAPT. This at a time when we're seeing the erosion of trust. I know the Edelman Trust Barometer points to a loss of trust in so many of our institutions. Why is that happening, and why is it important that we reverse that trend?
So 18% of the world's population feel the system is working for them. You go back two decades, that would have been 70%. That's a massive loss of trust, right? And I think it's related to things we talk about. So it feels like I don't have as good a future as the generation before me did. It feels like the world is at odds with itself. It feels like the institutions aren't keeping up and supporting me. It feels like technology is going to take my job away. Why would you trust the system? Right. And so in part, we have to solve two problems simultaneously. One of them is we have to address the issues that are causing the distress. And the second is we have to recreate trust in the institutions so they can function for us, right? And I think that requires two primary things. First is focus on the things that are truly material for the business you run or the institution you run, and get them working really well, really fast, right? And be transparent about how successful you are and what you're doing to correct it midstream, right? The second piece is succeed in that effort, right? So, because if we don't solve the problems, distrust will retain. And if we're not clear that we're trying to solve them, but only the things we really belong in, trust will erode. So it's a hard problem. God bless the leader today who's trying to tackle that, but we need him.
Yes, we do. So the first step in addressing challenges is to identify them, which is what you've been doing. Now we need to have action. And we have to accept that the future is uncertain. We don't know who, if anybody, is going to step up and take these challenges on. You know, as I stated at the beginning of our interview, you appear to me to be an optimist and that you have faith in the human capacity to meet challenges. And so, therefore, by extension, these issues then are so significant that even you are concerned. So what do we need to do going forward for you to remain optimistic? Because to me, you're now the scorekeeper.
Yeah, I'd rather not be. Thank you. I wanted to be invisible, remember? But two things, I think. One of them is one of the silver linings from COVID is we learned how to do important things massively and quickly. So keep that up, right? Find the thing that matters most right now that really is urgent and focus on it and address it. Then go to the next one and focus on it and address it, right? And take some intervals to rest in between, but really focus and nail it, right? If you said, for example, in Canada, we've really harmed small business and we have a climate issue. Just take those two and really address them really quickly and fast. And then bring everything else with it on coattail, right? So, because it turns out if you're going to address those two issues, you have to deal with a lot of the other issues as well. You have to deal with disparity. You've got to deal with education. A lot of other things will come with it. The second thing, I think, is for the shareholder to step up and ask of firms a different contract, which is, I want you to build for me an organization that is sustainable into the future. And I think they're beginning to, yes. So most shareholders are either pension funds or families that have so much money, they're thinking hundreds of years, right? Or sovereign wealth funds. Most shares are held by those three groups. And all three of them have a reason to care about sustainable success, not short-term success. So redefine what they mean by success in the client, which is, I want preserved value. And if we do those two things, so there's pressure into businesses to do what we need to do, and there's support and pressure from civil society and government to do what they need to do, which is focus. And then I think the third one is actually bring the two together and let's have some public-private solutions. If those three things happen, I'm optimistic.
I'd love to have you back for a follow-up conversation to see how we're doing in rising to meet these challenges that threaten our world.
I'd be delighted. This was an enjoyable conversation. I'd be delighted to come back.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us.